Good morning.
Good morning.
Welcome to Prairie Unitarian Universalist Fellowship. I don't know if we have any new folks this morning or people who haven't been here too many times, because sometimes I think if I do my the usual opening, welcoming, you've all heard it, and you know, you're doing your grocery list in your head and you're planning the rest of the day. But we are a welcoming congregation, and you are more than welcome to be here, no matter what your religious beliefs, your ethnicity, your gender preference, who you love. We try to be welcoming. I always encourage folks to come more than one Sunday if they're new or have only been here once or twice, because our services can be very different. Sometimes I do the service, Reverend Sandra Ingham, better known as Sandy. Sometimes people from outside the congregation do the service, and sometimes people within our congregation do the service. In keeping with today's theme of introducing you to a small band of liberal women ministers whose work took place in what was then the frontier of this country, which is right about here, the Wild West, I share with you these welcoming words of Unitarian minister Mary Safford, who used them in her Humboldt, Iowa congregation from 1880 to 1885, when she was the minister there. She said that her church welcomed all people of goodwill, regardless of religious connection, and drew no sharp lines between sacred and secular, but would try to discover God, the power that makes for righteousness, in whatever learning and truth its members could find. I think those are perfectly fine words for us as well, 135 years later. Penny, would you like the chalice? Thank you. For centuries, people have told stories, celebrated life, and approached the ultimate while gathered around a fire. Today, we light this chalice that the hearth fire of our hearts may be rekindled, that our stories may be retold, that we might celebrate life anew, and that we might approach what is of ultimate value. The reading I would like to share with you this morning is titled The Duck of Enlightenment by Unitarian Universalist minister Kathleen McTeague. She writes, "One spring afternoon, I went home a little early so I could claim an hour of study time before my children got home. As I opened the door, I was greeted by both cats, which was a little odd because they don't usually condescend to notice our coming and going unless it's dinner time. One of them promptly bolted out the open door, while the other wrapped himself persistently around my legs. As I stood puzzling over this behavior, at the edge of my vision, I caught a sudden motion in the family room, where there should be no motion at all in the empty house. With the hair rising on the back of my neck, I slowly moved into the house and rounded the corner of the room. And then I saw it. There was a duck in the family room, a wild brown duck, a live duck in the family room. My brain actually stopped completely for a couple of heartbeats. What should the brain do, after all, with so utterly unexpected a sight? I stood there in the doorway and said out loud, "There is a duck in the family room," as though it would help me believe it. None of the windows were open. The doors were properly closed. The duck huddled in the far corner of the room next to a clutter of books and DVDs, radiating the hope that if she kept perfectly still, I wouldn't see her. Carefully, I caught her up, a small wood duck, female, her heart tapping frantically against my hands, and carried her outside. I looked at her, full of wonder for this little visitation. Then I opened my hands. She leapt into the air in a great arc of liberation and beat her wings in a straight line of escape all the way to the horizon. I went back inside to investigate the breach of household security, and within a few minutes, the mystery was explained. A trail of ashes spilled from the fireplace, and here and there on the wall and the ceiling, against the ceiling, I saw soot in little feather-shaped impressions where the duck had thrown herself up toward the light. It all made sense then, how a duck could come to be standing in the middle of my house. But I felt lucky that for the space of a few breaths, my linear deductive mind had been shocked into silence. When something tumbles us into that state of wonder, the unexpected quiet in our heads is like a window flung open on the world. Instead of the routine, predictable ways, predictable story we live each day, there is something new under the sun. And, surprised out of our minds for a moment, we actually see. Startled awake, we receive what's in front of us. Simple, astonishing, unedited. Afterward, basking in the dazzlement of my visitor, it occurred to me that it really shouldn't require a duck in the family room to awaken my wonder. Isn't the same lovely little wood duck just as wondrous, just as worthy of my awe and my open and grateful heart when she is out in the woods where she belongs? The real miracle is not that her frightened heart beat against my hands for a moment, but that her heart beats at all. That her heart beats, that my hands can hold, that my eyes can see. I chose that Prince Cinder's story for all ages for several reasons. One was because, as I said, we only had the very younger children this morning, although the older ones probably would have enjoyed it too. And the older ones are at Hindu temple, correct, Karen? Yes. So we need to more often, I think, bring up what the RE folks are doing and thank all those people who are doing it with the kids. Another reason for that story is that obviously we can change the narrative of our stories, which is very important for women, and was certainly very important in my growing up in the 60s and 70s and the feminist movement, being part of that. We need to remember that there are different ways to tell classic stories that just might help us break out of our boxes, change our assumptions, break down some walls, who knows. And the reading about the duck, well, it really shouldn't require a duck in the family room to awaken our wonder. I don't know whether or not some of my recent experiences quite fall into the same category as walking into your home to find a duck there, but I had some of the same reactions McTeague had to the duck. The more I delved into the stories of the liberal women ministers who made up what author Cynthia Grant Tucker calls the prophetic sisterhood, and her book is titled The Prophetic Sisterhood. The prophetic sisterhood was also known as the Iowa Sisterhood. Whatever name we attach to this small but powerful group of women, their stories are miraculous. More than once this past couple of weeks, I was awakened to wonder by their courage, determination, perseverance, by their prophetic voices. I found myself so immersed in their stories that I kept losing track of the present time in which I actually reside. This led to strange, unexplainable behavior on my part, minor events, but as odd to me as finding a duck in the living room, family room. I lost my library card one day. Now, that may seem minor to you, but that has never happened to me ever before, and I've had library cards since I was very, very young. I think I still have most of them, and I guard that card with my life. And a day or two after that, At the end of the day, I realized that I had been wearing mismatched socks. Two very different socks were on my feet for the entire day. And if you know me at all, you know I love crazy socks. I don't think I've worn mismatched socks since I was 3 or 4 years old. I tell you these mundane things because I hope to impart some of my enthusiasm for the prophetic sisterhood to you in the next few minutes. But first, we need to consider the word prophet. What is a prophet? As you might suspect, one of the dictionary definitions is one who speaks for God, capital G, or a deity. Another one that won't surprise you is one who foretells future events, a predictor. But these aren't the only definitions, and they're certainly not the best ones. I like this definition. A prophet is one gifted with more than ordinary spiritual and moral insight. This kind of prophet would make a declaration of something to come based on what is happening right now, not based on any or because of divine inspiration, and certainly not speaking for any God, but a prediction of things to come based on being in the moment and paying attention to what is actually really happening in the moment. So I'm describing a Buddhist-inspired, Buddhist-leaning prophet, which leads to another good definition of what a prophet might be or do: an effective or leading spokesperson for a cause, doctrine, or group. Most importantly, a prophet is someone who is ahead of her or his time, often way ahead. This quote from contemporary Unitarian Universalist minister Mark Bellatini might help you better understand what I mean by the words prophet and prophecy. Mark writes, "We are a liberal church community which has not only dared to preach freedom, but to live freedom as well, which has not only prophesied a more just day to come, but has dared to live prophetically right now." So why do we call this small group of women the prophetic sisterhood? Because they looked at the world in which they lived, really looked at it. I mean, really looked at it. We don't do that. We don't try to take in and absorb the pain of the world, because it's difficult to do it. And then what the next step would be, what? These women were able to understand the world in which they lived, absorb just how broken it was. Remember, the Civil War had just ended. And then they predicted how that world could be improved, how they could help with that, what part they could play in healing the world. They were the eternal optimists. Because they form and get together right after the Civil War, and they fall apart right after World War I, which would have done in any optimists. These women knew, they predicted that the future would be very grim for large numbers of people unless people were part of communities of love and compassion. Well, how are these women wild, you might ask? Well, they weren't exactly, at least not in the sense that we often use that word. In fact, I've been told that if you Google wild women of the West, you'll get some interesting things, but you won't find any liberal women preachers from the time period I'm talking about, the 1870s until about 1930. So these women weren't really wild, except, I mean, in the Googling wild sense, except in the very, very important sense of being way, way ahead of their time, making them prophetic. But why are they important to us? Well, remember, I'm a history major, so of course they're important to us in the most general sense, because history is or should be important. What's that saying? If we don't know where we have been, how will we know where we are going? The most important thing about learning history, studying history, is story, not dates, You can always find those. I mean, eventually you have to know when things happen, especially in relation to other things. But the stories of those who came before us help us, as nothing else can, understand our own stories, and from that, understand our place in the world, what it means to be human, how to live in community. These women are also of interest to us because they lived here. They lived where we live, Iowa, Wisconsin, Minnesota, Michigan. That was the Wild West then. But most significantly, the stories of women of the prophetic sisterhood and of the men who supported them should fill us free-thinking folks with gratitude. We might not be here in this space in the year 2014 had these people not come before us, safeguarding our faith, defending against unbelievable odds, our right, our innate right to search for truth, to speak truth without dogma, doctrine, without anyone telling us what we should believe. There's certainly a very good chance that I, as a woman, wouldn't be standing here had it not been for these liberal women ministers in the late 1800s and early 1900s. Try to imagine what it must have been like to live then, beginning in 1870 and, as I said, up to 1930, but especially there at the beginning. It's one thing to imagine living physically, logistically, maybe, without cars, without phones, without hair dryer, toaster, a coffee maker, all of which I used this morning. Using coal or wood to heat, no indoor plumbing, generally. Life was hard, very hard. Imagine living then. No central heating, especially through a winter like the one that we have just gone through. And for me, it's even more difficult to try to imagine living in those times in terms of the culture, the society, the expectations of society, the rigid roles of men and women, the boxes people. I know we're still put in boxes, but those boxes were even more rigid, I think, that people were put into and expected to stay there. I try not to have regrets about things in my life that I should have done or that I should not have done. Can't go back and do them over. But one of the regrets that I do have is something I did not do when I was a minister in Burlington, Iowa. Part of my job was to go to Keokuk, Iowa, twice a month and do a service there. Now, I brought visual aids in case anybody, but I'm not going to open them up. If you're not familiar with the geography of southeastern Iowa, it's just across the river from Illinois. Missouri's there too. I would often go, I should really have had a blow up of this. I would go to Keokuk via Nauvoo, Illinois, which some of you may know is a big Mormon community with a temple. Well, it's not the temple, but it's a replica. It's out in the middle of cornfields, sitting on the Mississippi River is this big Mormon temple. So in order to get there that way, to Keokuk through Nauvoo, I had to go through Hamilton, Illinois, which is also right on the river, on the Mississippi River. But I never stopped there. I never stopped to explore and to try to find City Hall. I don't know if there is a City Hall. This is a village now. But there must be some place there that keeps records from the 1800s. Now, why would I want to explore Hamilton, Illinois? Because two of the most important women from this little band of female Unitarian and Universalist ministers who accepted positions in the West were born and raised on farms along the Mississippi River in Hamilton, Illinois, Mary Augusta Safford and Eleanor Elizabeth Gordon. And a third woman who was part of this group, Carrie Julia Bartlett. Some of you may know her as Caroline Bartlett Crane. We'll get to that later. She wasn't born in Hamilton, but she grew up there. You probably won't remember these names, nor the names of others that I'll mention. But just saying their names out loud and knowing that they are part of our heritage should be enough to fill you with wonder and gratitude, especially after hearing a little bit about their lives. Mary Safford, born in 1850, raised Presbyterian, as I was, loved to play preacher on the farm with her best friend, Eleanor Gordon, who was just 9 months younger. They used a tree stump for a pulpit. Mary's mother thought that Mary would outgrow this preaching game and eventually take her place in the Presbyterian church, working in the kitchen and praying from the pews. But as role models, Mary's parents said one thing and did another, which is not uncommon behavior for parents. Mary's father, Stephen, was a farmer and a teacher, and he kept having to explain himself to the church board because he was much, much more of a free thinker than a rigid doctrinal Presbyterian. He believed that the Bible was fallible. He believed in abolition. He believed in Darwin's theory of evolution. In other words, he was a heretic. Remember, that word just means to choose. Sadly, Mary's father died when Mary was only 9 years old. Her mother, Louisa, was left with 6 children to raise and a farm to run. Louisa turned out to be a better manager of the farm than her husband, and she was able to pay off the debt and run a very successful farm. So she kept telling her kids, especially her female children, you have to do this, you can't do this. When you grow up, you can be this, you can't be that. But that wasn't the way she was living her life. And then there was Eleanor's influence on Mary. Eleanor's family was like a miniature parliament of world religions. There were radical Unitarians, Orthodox Unitarians, a spiritualist, Baptists from all across the theological spectrum, and lots of debates about religion. Questioning was encouraged, which made Eleanor the bane of her Presbyterian and Baptist Sunday school teachers. Eleanor Gordon, I might add, was the minister in Burlington, Iowa from 1900 until 1902. I was the minister in Burlington, Iowa from 2002 until 2005. When still a child, Carrie Julia Bartlett rebelled against her religious upbringing. She didn't believe, and this is her quote, that a God worth caring about could inflict pain as arbitrarily as the church said he did. Nor did she believe that unbaptized babies and so-called heathens in other countries were sent to hell. Well, that resonated with me because that was the beginning of my own theological downfall. I couldn't believe that either. Carrie refused to believe that Jesus, for whom she felt deep affection as a human being, had been involved in anything as, and this is her word, impossible as the resurrection. She was not very popular with her Sunday school teachers either. Mary and Eleanor made a pledge in the mid-1870s, and this might be one of the reasons why I'm so drawn to their stories, because I made a pledge with my best friend, not in the 1870s, but I mean, a century or so later. On a summer day in the 1870s, when they were in their early 20s, sitting in their usual place under an old apple tree, they made a pledge that they would spend their lives together serving the world as a team. For Safford, this would mean as a minister. For Gordon, this would mean as a teacher, although she eventually became a Unitarian minister too. My friend Karen and I resolved to work together throughout our lives to end war on the planet. We're not finished. But in fact, Karen has become a Jehovah's Witness, so we don't talk. Mary Safford and Eleanor Gordon wanted to go to college, but there was no money to do so, so they studied on their own to get the equivalent of a college degree. They were greatly influenced by Emerson, who had been writing in the 40s, 30s, 40s, and 50s, 1830s, 40s. Especially by these two beliefs of his. We should use book learning to make the world better, and we should find the divine within ourselves. Same divinity found in Jesus is also in you, Emerson said. We don't need intermediaries to find the truth. Gordon and Safford were becoming not only free thinkers, but humanists to some extent. But more than Emerson, Eleanor and Mary were especially fond of Theodore Parker because he took unpopular positions on social justice issues. Parker's one of the Unitarian ministers back east in the Boston area who had a gun up on the pulpit, just in case the rowdy people were who were pro-slavery were throwing rocks into the windows, and this did happen. So Eleanor and Mary were quite taken with Parker because Parker believed that religious communities needed to spend less time in prayer and more in ethical action. It was through their reading of Parker that they discovered the philosopher Comte, who defined God as collective humanity, a definition I really like, collective humanity. Well, here these women are. They're reading about Unitarianism and Universalism, and they're reading the Transcendentalists, but they're also hearing Unitarian and Universalist ministers. They often heard Oscar Clute, who was the Unitarian minister in Keokuk, Iowa at that time, and he convinced Mary and Eleanor to start their own church in Hamilton. So they did. They didn't even use the tree stump from the orchard. They began planning services in the spring of 1879. There's just not enough time to go into so much of their stories. These women were able to raise money to build new buildings, new churches, and pay off the mortgage, usually within 4 to 5 years. And they didn't ask Boston. That's another, they did ask Boston. Boston didn't want the women doing what they were doing. That's a story that I'm going to be telling you 3 weeks from now. And that was the end of the prophetic sisterhood. So Mary and Eleanor start this church. In 1879, in the spring, by the end of the year, the Sunday attendance in Hamilton was over 150, with as many as 200 on some Sundays, and they had church-sponsored lectures and plays all week in the evenings, and they provided services for a satellite group of folks 8 miles out in the country, which would have been fairly far away. Clute was not the only man who helped them start this church. Jenkin Lloyd Jones played a part. Now, a big, big part. Some of you may know that name because of his relationship to Frank Lloyd Wrong. Right. Yes. His architecture is beautiful, but okay, we won't go there right now. Jenkin Lloyd Jones was Frank Lloyd Wright's uncle. But Jenkin Lloyd Jones was a famous man in his own right then, in the late 1870s. I mean, we don't know much about him now. He was the American Unitarian Association's Western Secretary. And, I mean, I guess that kind of meant he was the boss of the Western District. But he was having a heck of a time finding any clergy to fill the pulpits in the West, and there were just churches sprouting up everywhere. For a number of reasons, the Eastern-trained young new male ministers did not want to go to, this is a quote, the border of civilization. But that's where they were most needed. The partnership that the prophetic sisterhood, the Iowa sisterhood, formed with Jenkin Lloyd Jones to provide ministry on the western frontier of our country would last roughly 50 years, 1880 to 1930. It's important to remember that there were a lot of men who supported the prophetic sisterhood. I've mentioned Clute and Jones and William Channing Gannett, but there were others. And I suspect that had he been familiar with the term cloning, Jenkin Lloyd Jones would have probably wished that he could clone these women. He had so many parishes that needed ministers. After Hamilton, Iowa, that congregation was firmly established, Jenkin Lloyd Jones asked Safford and Gordon to go to Humboldt, Iowa. Maybe I should get the map out again, but it's farther west, where a Unitarian group of free thinkers was already building a church. So Mary and Eleanor went to Humboldt. They stayed for 5 years, where they found, quote, life to be harder than anything they had ever known. Now remember, they grew up on farms. They lived in an upstairs apartment. No plumbing, no central heat. Everything had to be carried in and out. Water and fuel in, garbage and ashes out. As my sister would say, they needed a boy. And eventually they did make enough money to hire someone to help them with that, but they didn't make much money. There was poverty and illness to deal with and a harsh climate. Not that we would know anything about that. They worked 18-hour days. But this work was not just a challenge physically. Their Unitarian and Universalist faith was constantly being challenged. There were plenty of Orthodox Christians who had also moved west and regarded the free thinkers as heretics. Yes, that word again. Free thinkers, Unitarians and Universalists, were persecuted, harassed, ostracized, made fun of, and mocked at revivals. Presbyterians, Methodists, Baptists, even Calvinist Congregationalists would boycott businesses owned by so-called heretics. Unitarian and Universalist churches needed to be, as Mary Safford put it, outposts of rationality and human warmth. Despite all of this, Safford's and Gordon's Unity Church, they named it Unity, became the town's fastest growing attraction. Here are the words that were on the walls: freedom, fellowship, character in religion, truth for authority, not authority for truth. I don't have time to give you what I wanted to give you. Maybe in 3 weeks I will. A little blurb of one of Safford's sermons. I'll just say that there wasn't much Christ in her theology, though there wasn't any. But she would have used Jesus as a good example of how we should try to live. Her sermons would not have been similar to what most of the Unitarian preachers in the East were preaching during this time period. Unitarian Church was afraid of no subject. Most of all, the Humboldt Church was so different from the Unitarian churches in the East because intellectualism was not the most important part of the Humboldt Church experience. The sisterhood believed, with Theodore Parker, that intellectualism was useless unless and until it was integrated with current affairs and community service. Now, there are recurring themes here, and I'll get more into this in 3 weeks. These themes become connections with our lives right now, so connections between their lives and now. And I call these the STNC factor. Some things never change. Here we are today, almost halfway through the second decade of the 21st century, and we are still debating whether or not community service and current affairs, aka social justice, is the primary purpose for forming communities of faith. Humboldt became a hub for the female ministers on the frontier, especially in Iowa, a place to reconnect and strengthen their network. And by the West, you've probably gathered this, but I mean Western Pennsylvania out to South Dakota. I grew up in Western Pennsylvania. The people in the Boston area moved when they wanted to move west to not be missionaries, we don't use that word, can't use that word, but to build churches, went to Meadville, Pennsylvania, which is 18 miles from where I grew up. That was west. Okay, once again, Safford and Gordon were asked to move to a new pulpit, start a new church, once that Humboldt Church was firmly established. This time, they went to Sioux City, Iowa. Within 18 months of their arrival, membership went from 26 to almost 200. During this period of time, they took a sabbatical. They went to that liberal Mecca, also known as Boston, where they were surprised and disappointed. It was too tame there, theologically, that is. After hearing Harvard professor Andrew Peabody speak, you might have heard of the Peabodys, Eleanor said that, quote, she doubted that he had read anything written within the last century. She said the Easterners needed speakers who knew how to talk to people, not at them, nor over them. The women were constantly fighting isolation, loneliness, prejudice, discrimination that may be difficult for us to grasp. And this time I'm referring to prejudice and discrimination based on their gender, not their religious beliefs. One of the women, Marie Jenny Howe, commented that she doubted that more than 1 in 100 women really liked sewing as much as the typical clergyman seemed to think. People were beginning to read Freud's works during this time period, and you know, Freud, I don't have anything nice to say about Freud. Freud, who questioned how women's lives could be anything but inadequate and empty if they did not have husbands and children. And most of these women made conscious decisions not to marry. And the ones who did marry rarely had children. The prophetic sisterhood was always, always trying to break out of the culture's defined roles for them and fighting to be recognized as intelligent, responsible, capable human beings equal to men. And the sisterhood was always, always at odds with Boston. But as I said, more about that later. One more short story about the women on the frontier. This one takes place in Sioux Falls, South Dakota. A pulpit that only had female ministers from the very beginning. Eliza Wilkes, who had been preaching in the backwoods of South Dakota and Iowa and for many, many years, with the blessings of both the Unitarians and the Universalists, she was asked by some 30 religious liberals in Sioux Falls to start a Unitarian congregation. So she did, but her interest was in starting up new congregations. She didn't want to be the permanent minister of any of these. She asked Boston to send candidates for the Sioux Falls congregation, but Wilkes said while they were likable enough, they were too academic and didn't seem to understand that in the West, a minister had to speak plainly and be concrete. Wilkes complained that a course at Harvard is not sufficient antidote for a lifetime in orthodoxy. You cannot plant Eastern Unitarian churches in this soil. So the norm in Sioux Falls was to have a female minister. Pulpit was female domain. Well, something didn't seem quite right when their minister exchanged pulpits with a male colleague. One day there was a pulpit exchange, this is from Eliza Wilkes' journals, which brought a male minister to Sioux Falls. The Wilkes' little girl, Queenie, had been so thoroughly unprepared and scandalized that she cried out in a whisper that everyone heard and many repeated for years, "Look, Mama, there's a man up there in the pulpit." In 3 weeks, I will continue with the stories of these women and tell you about the end of the prophetic sisterhood, the end as far as Unitarian and Universalist ministry went, but not the end of their work. They were pretty much forced out of the Unitarian Universalist Association, which was then known as the AUA, American Unitarian Association. When that happened, they expanded their ministry into the wider world. They knew firsthand that, as Reverend David Blanchard phrased it in a meditation I've used here before, life in community isn't always easy, but it's the only place we can practice being human. Liberal religion is not easy street, but we have so much to offer. Those liberal women ministers on the frontier put these words into practice every day of their ministries. These women were both. I didn't take time to distinguish between them. Some of them were Universalist raised, some of them were Unitarian raised. They were ordained within their congregations because Boston didn't recognize female ministers yet. If here you have found freedom, take it with you into the world. If you have found comfort, go and share it with others. If you have dreamed dreams, help one another that they may come true. And if you have known love, give some back to a bruised and hurting world. Go in peace. And greet your neighbor.